page 23, side 1, House Committee on Judiciary, full committee, March 16, 1979, 8:30 a.m. Room 350, work session on HB 2273, HB 2199, HB 2076.
Essentially neutral women.
After you show that, we'll come to order.
That is quite
right. May I have a little respect and attention, please? Attention is not respect. The public notice says that we may act on or hear any bills that were noticed for Thursday, March 15th. And since we had notice 2448, we do have that technically before us, and proper notice has been given. And the chair will recognize Representative Riles for the purpose of testimony.
Thank you. Representative Frohmeyer, for the record, I'm State Representative Nancy Riles from House District 5, and I'm here this morning to give testimony on House Bill 2448. And I don't know how much testimony you've had regarding this bill. I know there is, you haven't had any. I know there is some talk in the corridors, and some people may say that House Bill 2448 is insignificant or unnecessary. But an important relationship exists between how words are used and the message which is conveyed by those words, a relationship which I think makes this bill very important. Certainly in the past, when we used the word chairman, we tended to visualize a man in that position, although it was said to be understood that the term applied to a woman as well as a man. The word itself conveyed a meaning that was not necessarily intended. Thus, while I understand that he, in a legal sense, can be interpreted to include she, I personally find it disturbing to read laws written in masculine terms which refer to men only. Our laws establish the rules and policies which govern all of us. It is most important that we use appropriate language to convey the idea that they do indeed apply to all of us. As a new legislator, it has been very pleasant for me to see the number of my male colleagues who are attuned to this, and there has been two times when fellow male members have mentioned in bills sexist language and have moved to correct that sexist language. Therefore, I think House Bill 2448 certainly does not propose anything new, but it just continues to clarify by statute that which we are trying to do in this session and in previous sessions. I think it's a positive and important step to ensure that our laws are written so as to fully convey the very basic American idea that our laws apply equally to us all, and I urge your support of this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Riles.
You're welcome.
Questions of the committee of the witness?
Mr. Chairman. Representative Brown, do you know if have you been concerned with the bill quite a while?
Have I been what?
Have you been concerned and interested in the bill for quite a while? Do you know if there would be any extensive cost in changing, let's say, the statute?
Not to my knowledge, no.
I'm trying to visualize what you're doing to the statute.
Mr. Chairman, I might reply to that. It's prospective.
Yes,
okay.
This talks about those that are adopted or amended after the effective date of the act.
So I don't. I, to my knowledge, I don't know how it could be any more expensive to do that. There is one more letter in she than there is in he. But hopefully we're not going to be using
well,
it.
What I'm wondering is
the person.
Yeah, right.
Two more women than men.
If you get the part where you normally use the male personal pronoun, would you have to say he or she in each case? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, I think that we could leave up to the drafting. The bill specifically says that when it's necessary to refer to gender, because there are laws where gender is an important consideration or it's part of the law, then that would be so designated. But it would be in situations like when we refer to property. We would be the property, and you write it in the possessive so that it doesn't refer to his property. And I think, you know, as we look at legislation that's coming out now, it's most generally addressed in that way.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Is this the full committee meeting this morning?
This is the full committee. It now has six members present.
What is the condition of the bill, Mr. Chairman?
The condition of the bill is that it was reported out favorably by a subcommittee, and a motion was made yesterday to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the motion failed by, I think, one vote. but any motion is in order.
Can the chairman kind of speak a little bit to this issue?
Yes, ma'am.
Since I'm, my name is also on the bill. And I stated this in subcommittee, and maybe repetitive for some of you. The problem with dealing with this was that Kathleen Buffet has been doing this routinely and has instructed her people. But they feel as if they really need a statutory direction, and they would appreciate that. And so, of course, it's one example that was passed out on to me this morning was a reference from Gretchen Kifori. The bill that, Sandy carried, and I'll let Sandy speak
bill.
To it, and so I guess I'll rest my case and let her discuss it for a minute.
So, Bill 2404, and it changed the word fireman to firefighter in the statute. And once I sat down and finished carrying the bill and it passed, I noticed every word, every other pronoun in the bill was a male pronoun. It was not conformed.
Well, what should it
be?
Been?
A hint.
Should have been done.
The firefighter.
Well, firefighter doesn't connote gender.
No. Every other pronoun in the bill was his or him.
Oh, I see.
Representative Richards, I see the same thing happened to me on the bill that I carried on the floor on Tuesday that dealt with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and I thought I had read it fairly carefully, but then it was Doc Stevenson, Representative Stevenson, that came over and said, Nancy, do you realize here are those, and I'm going to vote for the bill, but I'm going to suggest that in the Senate change it. So it's an intent, and people have it, and you can be fairly aware. But I think the law here that clarifies that, we're still going to have things slip through, but I think the bill still needs to pass.
If it's appropriate, Mr. Chairman, I would I would move the full committee reconsider the vote by which it failed to pass. Sorry for you.
Before I place your motion, Dr. Dugas, I'm going to ask staff counsel if a motion to reconsider is necessary. It's been the chair's understanding in years past that if a motion is made to pass and the motion fails, that the motion is still in order at any time, and if the reconsideration motion is not needed unless a successful motion has been made.
You don't need to reconsider motion.
I thought you were talking to John. Yeah, that's right. According to Mark, the bill is in limbo. It's been tabled or passed. It's just
failed to pass. Oh,
failed to pass.
So I would change my motion, Mr. Chairman. I would move a passage to the floor with the due pass. I assume there are no amendments.
There are no amendments that are shown in my
House Bill 2448.
Representative Dugas moves that House Bill 2448 be sent to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards.
Just one question. We are not going through systematically the whole body of law and making the changes. We are making the changes in the statutes that
as they
change.
That's correct.
Thank you.
From the bill's perspective.
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugas?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Lombard?
Yes.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Brohmeyer?
Aye. Carries. Thank you. Joan?
I would like to request that that the committee vote that House Bill 2089, which was passed out yesterday, be printed in gross. Because
right.
We forgot to do it.
Before I do that, Representative Cohen, would you like to carry House Bill 2448?
Okay.
If you don't want to, I'm sure
no.
Another person would be
happy. I don't have any problem.
Okay. All right, Jerry. Representative Smith?
If I may, I'd like to explain yesterday my no vote on this bill and why I voted yesterday. Substantially for the reason that no one took the time to testify on it or be here about it, and I just felt it was inappropriate to go charging ahead. Neither Representative Cohen nor Richards was present, and there was no one here to testify who was carrying the bill. And I feel in agreement that it should pass today as I voted yes.
Thank you. The record will note your explanation. Senator Smith? I think we'll need a motion to reconsider on 2089. Representative Dugas moves to be reconsidered the vote by which we passed House Bill 2089. Is there any objection? Not so. The chair moves that, in addition to the motion that is due pass as amended, that the bill be printed in gross.
What was 2089?
Yeah.
The voting.
Voting.
Oh,
is there any any discussion? Is there any objection? All right. Chair has moved that the bill be printed in gross, sent to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Dugard?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Grohmeyer?
Aye. Carried.
That help was simply to provide printing and gross into that bill?
No, back to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I was chairing a committee yesterday morning, and I'd like just a moment to look at 2089. And actually take it. I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. We have just sent it back out.
But you could look for reconsideration.
Mr. Chairman, I was under the impression that we were voting simply to provide engrossment in the rulings for that bill.
What is it, Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
It has to do with
That has been a concern, but not an overriding one of mine as a policymaker. And I just, I felt uncomfortable because I wasn't able to be here yesterday.
The gap is too
fast. Yes.
Noted.
I didn't know what order the agenda was.
Well, let me hold off just a moment here, Dennis. Keith, you're here on 2199, are you not?
Yes.
And Robin, are you here on the same bill? Why don't we take that first and let our visitors go their own separate way. 2199.
Mr. Chairman, this bill examine it, changes the language in a number of statutory sections relating to appointment of counsel for indigent defendants. And in the sections of the statutes that are referred to or should be covered by the bill, the language normally used is shall appoint counsel, shall appoint suitable counsel. They leave it at that. The bill would expand the number of words that are used as a description to read suitable counsel for possessing skills and experience commensurate with the nature of the charge and complexity of the case. So that the intent of the bill is to not only have an attorney appointed, but attorneys who, by skill and experience, is capable of handling the case to which he or she is appointed. That's the first major aspect of the bill. The second major aspect of the bill on lines 19 and 20 allow appointment of a counsel even if the indigent person isn't completely indigent. That is to say, might be able to afford some attorney, but not an attorney well suitable by skill and experience to handle the case. So this bill would allow the appointment of counsel even if the person has some means. And the intent of the subcommittee was that the judge or magistrate appointing the counsel have the person contribute toward the cost of the counsel, but not doom him to having the cheapest low-budget counsel. And then the third aspect of the bill, down lines 31 and 32, expands this list of situations in which counsel would be appointed to include proceedings in which could subject a person to possible loss of liberty or substantial quasi-criminal sanctions. And that arises out of the case Hugh Duffy Brown versus Multnomah County District Court, that traffic case in which, because of the sanction involved, it was appropriate or is thought appropriate that counsel be appointed. Okay, that's the bill as it is before you. The subcommittee was presented with amendments, proposed amendments from two sources. One was from the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections, and that amendment, which was adopted by the subcommittee, expands the coverage of the bill to include proceedings under 419, Juvenile Code,
and parole revocation proceedings under Chapter 420. That's juvenile parole revocation.
Mr. Chairman?
What's your name, Richard?
I have a note from Lee Penny Dennis that says that we need to take special care that House Bill 2014, which is a new parole revocation proceedings for juveniles, that we need to make sure.
Okay. I talked with Lee after this hearing, or after the hearing on this bill, work session, and we agreed that juvenile parole revocation, which is House Bill 2014, is the better place to handle the amendment, part of the amendment that was put in here. And so the appointment of counsel in juvenile parole revocation should be handled in that bill and not in this bill. To that extent, Lee's asking that the subcommittee recommendation, the subcommittee adoption of her recommendation be amended. So 2014 is the vehicle for juvenile parole revocation. But as to Chapter 419, the juvenile code generally, she asks that the subcommittee's amendment of the bill, or recommended amendment, stand. That's the first. The second was from a lawyer named Stephen Gorham, who practices in Salem and does quite a bit of court-appointed work. He came in and asked that we include court-appointed attorneys and board-appointed attorneys in habeas corpus proceedings, mental commitment proceedings, and judicial review of psychiatric security review board proceedings. The subcommittee adopted his language, but then after the hearing, Mr. Gorham and I, in discussion, determined that that subcommittee adoption should be regarded as a conceptual adoption, and I prepared amendments, which you have before you, which actually plug in to the statutory sections which concern habeas corpus, mental commitment, and judicial review. In other words, it simply wasn't enough to include these few words. It was more appropriate to go to, Chapter 34, ORS 138.570, ORS 161.385, ORS 419.498, 426.100, and 427.062, and insert the language about suitable counsel possessing skills and experience commensurate with the nature of the case.
Dennis, where does the funding come out of in Psychiatric Security Review Board appointing counsel? Does they have real financial... When it comes to appointing counsel,
This bill provides
Board is almost broke.
Right. This bill provides that it changes the nature of the description of the counsel appointed, but doesn't say anything at all about who's going to pay for it. You've got a companion bill, 2198, which has been assigned to a subcommittee with Representative Smith, Richards, and Cohen to handle that. But that who's going to pay for it wouldn't really be affected by this bill. This just talks about when the counsel is appointed, what the nature of his skill and experience is.
There is one pay provision in here going to the current law regarding post-conviction relief, which is usually filed in Marion County, and it can be transferred back to the county where the conviction occurred. And
which one is that? Yeah. Again,
that's kind of perhaps an analogous situation.
You're right.
Then, if it does go back to the county where it occurred, the original county.
Right. But that's the existing statute. Only the underlying parts are new. And the underlying parts only describe the attorney. They don't say who's going to pay for it.
Keith, you can do it.
Not really. My comments would be general, and then if there are any questions, they'd be very brief. It's just the whole concept of having a counsel and for people who would not otherwise have it. That battle is behind us. If you don't have effective counsel, it's like no counsel at all, and that's really what this bill is addressing. We know that it has occurred. We know there are those lawyers that are readily available, and sometimes the judges may not take into consideration the seriousness of the offense, and this would require that. And so if we believe in that concept, which is really behind us, it seems to me that this is a very logical next step.
Keith, I'm going to support the bill, but I have the feeling that this is sort of the bar's wish list rather than something that's really enforceable. Isn't it of that nature?
The bar feels very strongly about this, Representative Frohmeyer, the whole issue of effective counsel for indigents and also adequate compensation for them. It isn't something that talking about lawyer fees generally. It's talking about those people that are not going to have their fair day in our judicial system unless these steps are taken. I think probably these may be the bills that the bar is most concerned about in this session.
Mr. Chair, I have the unfortunate privilege of participating in a post-conviction relief based on inadequacy of counsel in an appointed attorney situation, and I believe that had this bill been in effect, that attorney would not have been appointed, and he was obviously inadequate as appointed counsel. However, under the standards the court was operating under, which were the farce and mockery standards, that when you go on a post-conviction relief of inadequacy of counsel, the standard is whether or not the trial was farce and mockery. We were not successful. However, I believe that had this piece of legislation at that time been in effect, the whole problem would have been avoided. And you might also note that the courts, especially the California courts, are moving away from the farce and mockery standard of adequacy of counsel. I think we should take note of that change, the part of another jurisdiction, and note that this legislation would be consistent with that movement in the law.
Well, Representative Mason seems to me to raise an interesting point that hadn't occurred to me until now. Keith, maybe you can respond to this. If you're going after a conviction on collateral attack in a habeas proceeding, can you argue on the basis of this bill that not only is there a constitutional standard of incompetence of counsel under Andrews versus California, but that if the court didn't comply with what, in a Monday morning quarterbacking sense, it didn't appear to be suitable counsel, but you could attack on the basis of these statutory changes? Competence of counsel for purposes of collateral attack of convictions.
I suspect that's probably true.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith.
I have been thinking about that from the other point of view, however, that by virtue of an appointment through this statute, it can almost be noted that the person is deemed then to have skills commensurate with the task ahead of him.
That's possible.
Your question was whether or not it can be raised, and more likely to be because of this, and that's true. But I think that it's less likely to be successfully raised. Because I think the courts, I don't think the courts felt they had the tools, and courts are under attack for the appointing counsel that require greater fees, and I think this takes the burden off of their backs in that rule. So I think while it's probably going to be more likely that the issue will be raised, I think it's less likely that it will be a substantial issue.
This has been nibbling around my head too. I'm concerned that we might be guaranteeing proliferation of litigation attacking the suitability of counsel. And I don't know what this does with regard to clarifying a judge's judgment about who ought to be representing the indigent. But I'm wondering if every conviction now won't be attacked by the defendant in some fashion, or every defendant will holler, "Sure, I got convicted. I had a lousy lawyer. They violated this rule." I'm wondering if the opposite of what I think Representative Smith is imagining might not occur.
Well, courts traditionally have given great deference to the role of the trial judge in exercising that kind of judgment, discretion. I think what Chief says is right. Probably there will be more initial attacks, but at least if the judge has paid heed to the statute and deference is given to the judge's choice, as usually is the case, that maybe fewer of them are successful.
Do practitioners feel that this was would be that really this is just kind of a warning to the judge? Is that about all?
Representative Smith, do you want to respond?
Yeah. I'm sure Representative Mason's had the same experience in Multnomah County, which probably has the longest court appointment list. And I don't think it's ever been brought out to the committee that if you want to be a court appointed attorney, you merely have to go down to a special secretary who handles the appointments list and indicate your desire to be appointed. And when the judge orders from the bench that a person is then qualified by reason of indigency for court appointed counsel, it is delegated to a non-judge, and someone sitting clear down the hall merely looks at the alphabetical list of attorneys in many, many cases and takes the next one off the list based on when was the last time that person had a court appointment. And in smaller counties, I'm sure it's more true that the judge actually sits there with a list of the local attorneys on the bench, looks down and says, well, this is a heavy, we've got to have, you know, one of the timers to take care of the case. But I think this statute says, at least the judges in Multnomah County, that you'd better pay heed to who you've got in the stable out there and make a determined judgment as to which one's the best lawyer for this defendant. So I think maybe it'll improve the appointment system.
I know of a case, I'm not going to mention the judge, I'm not going to mention the attorney. I know of a case where an attorney objected to his present counsel. Defendant objected to his present counsel, a young man who was actually doing quite an adequate job at the defendant, who thought he knew an awful lot about the law and didn't, wanted the second shot. And a judge, again, who will remain unnamed, said, okay, you want another attorney? We'll give you another attorney. And proceeded to appoint a gentleman who I will not name, who was perhaps one of the most incompetent, dishonest members of the bar. He is not a member of the bar anymore. He resigned several months after this, under fire, on the verge of an investigation, which the suite I happened to have my office in was one prosecuting that investigation for the bar. But the judge appointed this attorney in retaliation for the defendant asking for a second attorney. And it was only after this defendant went through a whole trial, a whole circuit court trial involving a rape case, and at the end the judge asked the defendant, asked the attorney, are you retained or appointed? And the attorney, the incompetent attorney, said, I'm appointed, at which time the judge declared a mistrial on the spot on grounds of inadequacy of counsel, and much to his chagrin, because he had been under the impression throughout the whole trial that this poor defendant had indeed hired this man. But on finding that it was indeed a court-appointed counsel, declared a mistrial and appointed another attorney who handled the defense. The difference in the two defenses was on the first trial, the gentleman was convicted of first-degree rape and was about to receive a 20-year sentence prior to the mistrial being declared. On the second trial, due to some very competent plea bargaining after the defense attorney, the sentence was reduced to 5 years. Now, you can object to that reduction, but for effectiveness of counsel, that was a fairly effective job. The point being that there's some very, very inadequate counsel being appointed at the time.
Okay, I think we better move along on the bill. Robin, did you have anything to say? You're just keeping your eyes on it. Dennis?
I have one issue. As you noted, in the proposed amendments, 3.1479, almost all of them are amendments of existing statutory sections in which the legislature has already said there shall be a court-appointed attorney. But Section 3 on the habeas corpus, when I went to amend the appointment of attorneys for habeas corpus, there wasn't one, so I made it up out of whole cloth. I raised as an issue before you whether the omission from the Chapter 34 of a section relating to appointment of attorneys means that you should look more closely at that one. I don't know whether you're stepping into something new, and I just don't know. See what I'm saying? I'm wondering whether you are going into a new area.
habeas corpus only against public officials?
Isn't it?
That's my question.
No,
I'm not
necessarily. No.
What's the current standard now is, at least in the federal courts, is that counsel is not automatically appointed every time a petition is filed. Rather, the court goes through those petitions and determines whether or not any of them are valid enough to require hearing, and only then is consideration of counsel raised.
Well, I just wanted to call to your attention. You may want to change the language of Section 3.
I'm glad you brought that to our attention. I've got a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative,
more of all of your lawyers in the room, including Keith. This seems to broaden the right of a person to demand a writ of habeas corpus. Anybody who is without sufficient financial means.
This would be a...
Isn't that an unusual and...
Are you talking about the part where if they don't have adequate funds...
This amendment?
No, I don't.
Dennis just told us he just wrote this section. He just put those words together. Now, habeas corpus, I think we usually connect with a freeing of a person arrested for a crime. But isn't it kind of considerably broadening the...
I'm looking here for a bill that I think just came out. I can't put my finger, maybe I don't have it with me. I think the Supreme Court has a bill to do this, Dennis. I'm not mistaken, that it was just printed.
And to appoint counsel in habeas cases?
I'm not positive, but I think I saw it. I'm surprised I don't have it here.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, correct me if I'm wrong, but cannot a writ be used for purposes other than freeing a person from jail? It seems to me that a writ of habeas corpus can be used for recapturing a child that is taken wrongfully. And has nothing to do with criminal proceedings at all. And I don't know that this statute would allow a person who merely wants to regain their child's in a custody fight to use a writ at court-appointed expense.
Well, that's sort of why I brought up the question. I didn't have any direction from the subcommittee on that, and I wanted to get some direction from you as to what you wanted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mason.
The statute reads, under the purpose of writ, every person imprisoned or otherwise restrained at his liberty.
What I'm worried about, though, is aren't we allowing the use of the appointed counsel without a showing of indigence?
Now, that would be required, Representative Bugis. The more serious question in my mind is, I don't think there's a person incarcerated in the state of Oregon that has not filed a writ in Marion County. And, you know, we're talking about a full crew act in Marion County Bar.
Yeah.
If it's mandatory.
Yeah, this is what kind of true.
I just want to call that to your attention.
Yeah. Well,
you could delete that and put it in the other bill that Keith's talking about if that came before
the
committee.
I hate to be bound by that, Dennis, because my recollection is I saw the bill, but I'm surprised I don't have it with me.
Mr. Chairman, is that the bill that Senator Gardner introduced regarding court-appointed fees and on appeals, Supreme Court? I seem to remember.
No, this was dealt with habeas corpus alone, if I recall, and it was introduced at the Committee of Judiciary at the request of the Oregon Supreme Court.
I've seen it too.
What may be, Gardner?
There is a bill.
I'd rather deal with it separately.
Yeah. Well, we can do it one of two ways, Representative Dugas. We can make it discretionary with the court, but ensure that if counsel is appointed, the counsel is suitable. Or we can omit the habeas corpus provisions from this bill altogether. And what's the pleasure of the committee? I think we have to do one of the other.
My inclination is to omit the proposed amendments altogether and go with the bill as it originally was given to us.
Omit the proposed amendments with respect to habeas corpus or psychiatric security review board? The proposed amendments go clearly beyond habeas.
My feeling is right now I'm uncomfortable putting it in the statute for the mental commitment proceedings, psychiatric review, habeas corpus proceedings. I'm uncomfortable putting that in the statute altogether.
Well, Representative Smith, may I point out that the provision of counsel already exists in the mental commitment statute, and the only question is whether or not the word suitable counsel ought to be added. So it seems to me that the issue in the case of mental commitments is different than that of habeas corpus. Chair moves that the provisions dealing with the provision of counsel in habeas corpus not be included in the amended bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Mr. Chairman, I realize it'd be a horrible fiscal impact, but I've got to get.
All right. Clerk will call roll.
Representative Dugan?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Nope.
Smith?
Aye.
Frohnmeyer?
Aye. Carries.
Chairman, may I ask?
Jim Mason, yes, sir.
I voted to delete this section only on the assumption that the issue of habeas court counsel for habeas corpus proceedings will be addressed, and this other measure. There's something there that definitely should be looked at, but given the confusion over where habeas corpus does indeed lie in Oregon at this time, I voted for the deletion.
All right, the clerk will note that explanation when the minutes are written. Thank you very much. The chair moves that in every place in which the male gender is included in the proposed amendments, that if the gender be changed. By my brief count, it's 11 times, Dennis.
That's in the.
You've got that in.
It's in addition to what was included in the first provision.
You're talking about the actual statute that we're dealing with. In the back page.
I think you'll find it. Is there any objection to the amendment? Not further motions on the bill. Dennis, have the amendments been moved themselves?
No. Well, the subcommittee's recommendation is in the form of a motion, but then.
Which includes these proposed amendments as amended by the full committee?
I think you can move again.
All right. Chair moves the adoption of proposed amendments as amended and the memorandum of 3-14-79. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator.
I have one nagging question in the back of my mind. If we are going to make it more difficult to prove the adequacy of counsel with the tenor of the bill.
I don't think so, and I'm speaking for myself. We already have the constitutional standard.
What is that, by the way, Mayor?
Tom?
It's recently, the magic phrase now is partisan mockery for a trial. There's been some movement in the law away from that to skills commensurate to competent counsel. There's two different standards. It's very, very, very hard to prove inadequacy of counsel under the farce and mockery standard. However, under the skills commensurate type standard, you do have to make...
Are both those phrases in the Constitution?
No. They're both found on due process.
It's a
case examining suitability.
A whole series of them. And the movement has been towards a standard of competency. Not a lot of competency, but to give you an example, the only time that inadequacy of counsel has proven to be a valid ground for post-conviction relief has been when the counsel indeed did nothing, did absolutely nothing, simply put on no defense, and it had to be shown that the defense, there was a viable defense.
Okay. Any discussion? Chair moves House Bill 21.
I was laughing at my colleague on my left.
Chair moves that House Bill 2199, as amended, be sent to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Representative Bugis?
Aye.
N.B. Engross.
Thank you, Dennis. Representative Bugis, do you want to cast your vote again?
Aye.
Cohen? Aye. Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Frohnmeyer?
Aye. Carries. Representative Bugis, do you want to chair the balance of the meeting, please? We'll all be able to stay, so we have a quorum of five.
There's only two more bills.
All right, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank
you.
Can I move it out from over here?
Yes, you may, sir.
Just so you keep your calendars clear, you'll have an invitation Monday to a party for the Joint Judiciary Committees and staff for Tuesday, the 27th, 5:30 to 7:30 at Trumbull's Restaurant.
Go ahead. Which one?
2270.
Oh, you did. Okay, the hearing is now open on House Bill 2273. Do we have any witnesses?
I don't think so. Mr. Chairman, Keith Weissner is the main person who would be speaking on this bill. He came to me yesterday and said that he couldn't make it today. Asked me to carry the ball.
Probably.
This bill
probably
concerns where a lien is to be filed. by hospitals or owners thereof. In the case of people who might end up claiming under the motor vehicle fund, which provides for their, I think it's more than that. It just leans by hospitals for the cost of hospitalization. At present time, the hospital files in two places, in the county in which the hospital is located and the medical services are rendered, and also in the case of an injury which happened in a different county, in that second county. Pete came in and testified that he could see no purpose for the filing in that second county, the county in which the injury occurred. In those, I'm not sure whether they're frequent or infrequent, but in those cases in which there's two counties involved, it's just more paper. We checked with Max Doan of SAIF, who is one of the chief people concerned, or who would be concerned in this situation. He said that his agency doesn't have any position one way or the other on the bill, and by implication that it doesn't make any difference to him whether or not they file in the second county. The purpose of the bill is to cut down on paperwork which appears to be needless.
Now that we get into the bill, I remember a conversation with Pete along the same line. We appeared on a bill of mine, which I allowed him to amend, which passed the House the other day, and he talked about this, and the problem kind of arises very frequently in, take this instance, for instance, you're outside in Washington County, the accident which occurred in Multnomah County, you got a double filing requirement. The problem really occurs after the accident and then in the hospital where the lien is actually incurred. And it seems like common sense to me. I can see no clickers in it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Smith.
I move House Bill 2273 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Objection? Clerk, call roll.
Representative Cohen?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Measure passes. I don't know how we're signing, Kerry. Can we leave that to Chairman?
I'll leave it to Mark.
You were doing a fine job, Representative Mears.
Oh, I don't know where else. It's a complicated bill.
Mr. Chairman, last bill on the agenda is 2076, and I don't think you can act on it all the way through today. Let me just describe where we're at. 2076 relates to appeals from municipal or justice courts. They now go to the circuit court. This is one of the first bills you considered at the beginning of the session. The bill would have appeals from those municipal or justice courts go to district courts instead of circuit courts, or if there is no district court, to the circuit court. This seemed to be a pretty straightforward bill, and it was passed out of committee way back in, I guess, in January. It was signed to Kip Lombard to carry on the floor. When he prepared himself to carry on the floor, he looked and saw that the people behind the bill, and including the staff, hadn't found all the statutory sections which are affected. So the bill is incomplete. Even with House amendments. Warren Hicks and the other people from the Supreme Court came in and they said, here's our bill. We found a few other sections which should be included, and those are sections 5 and 6 in the printed House amendments. So he said, okay, you put those in. He sent the bill out of committee, and then Kip went to prepare himself, and he said, well, wait a minute, what about? And then these are the sections he found. Those include 53090, 157040, and 221.390. It's just a language change. That's all it is. But if you didn't act consistently, it made a mess of the statute. So he moved to have the bill re-referred to this committee, and it sat in our file since that time. Because I knew that we needed some bills for this morning, I had put it on the agenda. And so now you've got the amendments that you need to clean the bill up. There's just one thing. When I went to Kip and I said, look, everything's ready to go, right? He said, no, further questions had come up. So even if you adopt these amendments, and I think that to be consistent you should, because it follows on what you did last time, I think that Kip would ask that you hold off passing the bill out of committee. So when I put it on the agenda, I thought that you'd be able to get rid of it. But I think now that Kip would say, pass these amendments, but then still hold on to it until he has time to research his question.
You don't know the nature of his
So. Well, they have to do with whether, I think that you'll end up deciding they're not that substantial and you're not going to worry about them.
Okay.
But I think you have to lift, give
kids. We don't know what they are.
Yeah. They relate to other statutory sections which apply to appeals from these courts.
Can we take a look? Are you sure? Sure. Does anybody have a question? I just wondered if we could take a look at the amendments and then we could consider adopting them and adjourn.
Yeah.
While you're doing that, Dennis, are you convinced now that the search is all inclusive and covered all?
These are the ones that you missed last time.
What time?
1:30.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Richards.
Judicial conference brought it in and it wasn't in good shape. Then they came in and they said, there's some things we missed, and that's this, the printed house amendment dated the 25th of January. And then when Kip went to carry it on the floor, he said, yeah, but what about this? And this didn't exist in this form, but he found some sections. But even with that, he says there's still some more questions.
I just note my concern and consternation, Mr. Chairman, with the judicial conference bill in this condition.
Should have questioned that yesterday on the floor, Representative Richards, when we passed the budget for the judicial conference.
The judicial
business.
Judicial business.
It's more appropriate.
It's more appropriate. I agree, Mr. Chairman.
I chair would accept a motion to adopt the 315 amendments to House Bill 2076.
Probably not. Adoption of amendments dated 3/15/79 to 2006.
Is there objection? Discussion? They are adopted. Pursuant to the discussion, I would take it there's no more business before this or this whole committee. Any other business? We stand adjourned.
You did a fine job.